You may have detected a theme in our worship set today, so this might not come as a surprise to you, but did you know we need a king? We are made to follow a king. We love kings. We make stories about them. Even modern superhero myths are old king myths retold. The longing for the right king to emerge from the shadows and take his rightful place, it's an ancient yearning older than King Arthur. Now today, of course, kings are marginalized to meaningless pageantry, but there remains in kingship an enduring significance that is inescapable. It's something that's burned deep into our souls, something telling us that the world will only prosper when it's ruled by the true king. Now today's passage is about that true king. And today we're going to look at three things about kings. What a false king looks like. How do we get our real king back? And how we can be like the king. Now, the Bible is really a story about a king. It's a king whose subjects rebelled against him. A rightful king who then spends the rest of history making it possible for them to come back to him for all eternity. And no Old Testament book captures this in more completeness than Isaiah. Now, Isaiah writes today's passage in response to perhaps one of the worst kings ever. And you'll recognize the name, Ahaz. Now, under the leadership of Ahaz, Judah is in a terminal spiral. They're facing a two-front war. On one side, they have two nations that want to attack them and destroy them. On the other side is the world's only superpower, Assyria, and it's gobbling up neighbors like old Soviet satellites. And to boot, they've lost their way as God's people. They're involved in things like half-hearted worship. Did they disdain the poor among them? They chased the shekel after everything else. And even child sacrifice. That's unbelievable. Where false and illegitimate kings rule, evil reigns. What really sends Isaiah over the edge, though, is when Ahaz turns to Assyria for protection against the other two nations that are coming down on them. It's a king's sovereign right and duty to protect his people. So in the face of these two countries coming at him, Ahaz ignores his national security advisor, who says, hey, don't worry about it. God's got this. He doesn't trust the Lord, and instead, he runs to Assyria. So they essentially put their trust in politics. They were to make no political or military alliances under the covenant. So Judah is safe now, right? They've got the schoolyard bully, Assyria, protecting them. But you know what bullies do. Eventually, they turn on you, too. So while false kings promise security and freedom, what they really do is they enslave us. Assyria bled Judah dry. And all of our own false kings treat us the same way. So just when we're about to meet the standard of our false king, it's like Charlie Brown trying to kick the football. Lucy rips it away. Each time's the time we're finally going to hit the mark. Now, wealth and possessions are a great example of this. And that's why even though we live in one of the richest communities and times in human history, it seems like we never have enough. The rightful king must return. Now, the returning king in Tolkien's Hobbit is Thorin. He is the true king of the Holy Mountain. His father, Thrain, had fallen in love with gold, only to learn that dragons too love gold. So the rightful king was displaced by the dragon named Smaug. And as Tolkien describes him, he is the chiefest and greatest of calamities. And gold is behind it all. Here's something else about false kings. They're taskmasters. They only increase our burden. So if wealth is your king, you're only going to be happy until you hit your next 401k benchmark. If power is your king, you'll only be happy until you realize there's one more rung up the ladder. If work is your king, you'll only be happy if you're productive until you realize there's still more to do. If comfort is your king, you'll only be happy in that one big house up the street until you realize there's a bigger one just around the corner. Now, if parenting is your king, if having the perfect kids is your king, I don't have to tell everybody about that, right? But the list goes on and on and on. Now, here's some questions you can diagnose what your own false king is. Two questions. What am I most proud of in my life? And what do I worry about the most? Eventually, that false king can break you. I want to read you guys a paragraph written by somebody about worship. Here's what the author writes. He writes, in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what? To worship. Most people think things like, I'm just working hard to be a good writer. I'm just seeking to find someone to love me. I'm just working out so I can be a good steward of my body. I'm just working hard to accomplish something in politics or have a good career or make a little money for security. Now, he doesn't call them kings, but these are all potential kings. And he wraps up by showing us that worshiping anything other than God will devastate us spiritually. Listen to how he wraps this up. The compelling reason for maybe choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. We have to take this guy seriously, all right? You want me to tell you why? He's an atheist. He gets it, kind of. So, how do we get our real king back? The story arc of the Old Testament is that eventually the tension between the depth of sin of God's people and the strength that any human king would need to save them becomes in conflict. The power needed by any king to free them is too much. So the big question becomes this: how can any king be powerful enough to save us? No human king is enough. The answer is this: only a king who is God himself. We'll take a look at Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14. We're going to put that up on the board. In Isaiah's frustration, here's what he tells Ahaz, the bad king. He says, therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. The name Emmanuel means God with us. We need a God who loves us so much that he became human to lead us. Dorothy Sayers is one of the first women ever to graduate from Oxford University. She became a very popular writer of mystery novels. The main character in her novels was a guy named Lord Peter Wimsey. He's this aristocratic sleuth and like eminently eligible bachelor. And at one point in her series, a new character appears on the scene. And her name is Harriet Vane. Now, coincidentally, she is the first woman to have graduated from Oxford. And she writes mystery novels. Now, eventually, Harriet and Peter, they fall in love and they get married. But who was Harriet really? Many people say that Sayers looked into the world she created. She fell in love with her lonely hero. And she wrote herself into the story to save him. Pretty neat, but not nearly as amazing as the reality of the incarnation. God looked into the world he made. He saw our lostness and he had pity. So he wrote himself into human history as its main character, Jesus Christ. Some would say, though, some would say that God is no different than the false kings. He's got a list of rules. They're impossible demands. And you know what? You're right, because I've tried. They are impossible. In a typical king-subject relationship, though, when a subject fails to hold up his end of the deal, what happens? Off with his head. But the true king puts his own prince into the story to be punished for us. Jesus says, I will take the beating, I'll take the scourging, I will take the thorn of crowns, I'll be beaten so bloody you can't recognize me, and then I'll give my very life. His punishment for our failure, it does two things. The first thing is this, it frees us from the false kings. And then it makes us able to do what we could never do before. Be like the king. First, his forgiveness frees us from the false kings by inoculating us against failure. We're freed from going to the old kings for the acceptance we know they will never give us. The pressure's off. As Christians, though, we're still going to try really, really hard to be the best parents and employees and brothers and sisters and friends that we can. But we're not going to be crushed when we fail. I'm not under such pressure at work that I have to be unethical. I'm not so concerned about what people think about me that I do things I shouldn't do in order to be accepted. I'm not so concerned about my image as a parent that I have to be overbearing with my kids to make sure that I look good. All sin is actually trickle-down sin. Little acts we commit to please the false kings. Am I going to fail at the true king's standards? Yes. But he's the only king who won't slay me for my failure. The result is this. It's something called paradoxical obedience. A paradox is two things that don't normally go together. You never think they would. So even though we know we're going to fail, we love Jesus Christ so much that we're going to try like crazy to obey anyway. John Stott says, that's how we reconcile the opposites of our dignity as godlike creatures and at the same time deal with our depravity as fallen and guilty sinners. And that's really how Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of every single human aspiration. Failure doesn't crush me because he has been crushed for me, and I'm not proud and puffed up because I know that I'm just a sinner saved by grace. Stott says to find Jesus in every situation is to find our true selves. Now, earlier in our passage, early in the passage, chapter 11 and verse 2 and 3, we're going to pull that up right now, we learned a few things about the ideal king. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him. The spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the spirit of counsel and of might, the spirit of knowledge and of fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. That's the ideal king. Ahaz did not have the spirit. Very few people in the Old Testament did. Our rightful king does. And it's freely given to those who come to him humbled and brokenhearted by their failure. Only the Holy Spirit can change a heart. But instead of us bending our own hearts to his will, what happens when you bend something? It does one of two things. It either snaps back into its original shape or it breaks. Instead of us bending our own heart to his will, our love for Jesus melts it into a new shape. A shape that in the character of the true king delights in the fear of the Lord. So God's precepts are no longer something we have to do. They're something we want to do because we love the king. Now, if you've never come to Christ, powerless, humbled, and broken, and asked him to be your king, you wear the chains of the false kings. Romans 8 calls it the law of sin and death. If those chains have been broken, however, and you do follow the true king, I have some advice for you. Don't get cocky. All right? Because of the way we are made, we can follow more than one king at a time. The Puritan preacher John Owen wrote that even though sin is no longer a law unto believers, it's still in them. So when our identity, who we are, drifts back to things like work, wealth, power, influence, watch out. We can even cloak the false kings in God's precepts. When we look to acceptance to other Christians for how well we follow the rules, or we go to God thinking we deserve something from him because we followed the rules. That's not worship. That is voluntarily slipping the chains back on. Worshiping the true king is as elemental to our survival as water. If we don't get the real thing, like a castaway, even though we know it will kill us, we will eventually drink seawater. One of the first symptoms of seawater poisoning is that you start to go crazy. So when life gets a little crazy, check your king. Now lastly, following the true king does something else. It reverses values. We're going to look at chapter 11, verse 6 through 9. I'm going to read those to you. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear. Their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the cobra's den, and the young child put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the water covers the sea. Is that the weirdest passage or what? How am I supposed to figure that out? But that is not the way nature works, is it? I mean, the natural world is a dog-eat-dog, every-man-for-himself world. Nature is really all about the strong dominating the weak. You know, the idea of human rights or caring for the poor actually has no place in nature. But Jesus' death on the cross reverses that. Cruel Mother Nature herself gets turned upside down and reset to its original design. And it starts like this. Other people become more than just obstacles or competition or things to be used or eaten to get to my false kings. Natural enemies and competitors in the human food chain become friends. You know, since I'm forgiven, I can begin to see behind their fallenness and my fallenness too. And I can see and care for their needs the same way God loves and cares for them, every one of his creatures. Jesus Christ saved you by reversing values. He put himself where you deserve to be so we can be where he deserved to be, at his table. Unlike a typical king who a serf would never see, this king will eat with us. And he doesn't base his decision on whether we're good or bad because we're all bad. This king eats with sinners. In fact, he only eats with sinners. You can't strut into the hall of the king if you think you deserve it. In fact, the minute we do, he says, I'm not here for you. We have to come to the table humble and broken. Now, maybe you've been following the wrong king lately. Maybe I've been following the wrong king lately. Make a plan to spend some time with the true king every day. And the best way to get to know him is to experience his grace. His grace is free, but we have to give him something to get it. Our burdens and failures and deep, dark secrets of our heart. He knows that they're there already. He just wants to hear it from you. God's well of grace is inexhaustible, and it has to be because our own depravity is also bottomless. The deeper we mine into our hearts, giving over newly and bigger chunks of newly discovered darkness, the deeper into the well of God's grace we go. And that's how we really get to know God. Let me ask you guys a question today as I'm getting ready to wrap up. Who is your king? If you've never come to Jesus Christ and said, I want you to be my true king, today can be the day that you do that. You can lay it all down at the feet of the king. He will free you from slavery. You can see me. You can see Pastor David. You can come to the prayer corners after service. You can see one of your friends here in the congregation. You can see an elder. Don't wait. And if you already follow the true king, make sure we're not following more than one king. Don't voluntarily slip the chains on. Slip in and out of the chains from Sunday to Monday. Follow the true king every day. Now, I'm going to close by reading from Isaiah's fully developed picture of the true and rightful king. Like I said before, Isaiah has this fully developed picture of God's plan for humanity. We get a little taste of it in chapter 7. He gives us a hint, Emmanuel, God with us. In chapter 9, he goes a little bit further. Then in 11, he gives us this picture of the ideal king. And all the way through to the end of the book, he's building on this imagery of who the king is. In Isaiah 53, it comes to a head. It's a reversal of the way the world thinks about kings. King, the king is all powerful, most powerful being in the universe. He becomes what Isaiah calls the suffering servant. I encourage you to read 53 on your own, but I'm going to read you verse 2 to 5, all right? Listen to this. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. Nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by mankind. A man of suffering and familiar with pain. Like one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised. And we held him in low esteem. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him, afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him. And by his wounds, we are healed. This is the word of the Lord.